Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
All right. Hello, everybody. I want to welcome you to today's webinar, Key Lessons Learned from CECL Implementation. My name is Andrew Dial. I'm an audit manager here at GRF. Today, we are joined by my colleagues, Jennifer McCahill, a partner in our audit department, and Allison Conklin, a senior manager in our audit department. The three of us have a wealth of experience and knowledge in dealing with CECL implementation, so we have a lot of great stuff to share with you today. Before I turn things over to our speakers to cover today's agenda, let's kick things off with a quick polling question. So this is polling question number one. Has the CECL standard impacted your organization? Yes, no, or unsure? Just a reminder that if you would like CPE credit, please record a response to this question. Looks like we're still waiting on a couple more responses here, so we'll leave this open for another few seconds. Thank you, everybody. And as you can see here, we have a lot to cover today. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Allison.
All right, great. Thanks, Andrew. So here is our agenda for today's webinar. We'll dive in and give a brief overview of the CECL standard, and then we'll approach this webinar in four lessons. Lesson number one will be focused on the basics of revenue recognition and how we see this plays a role into the CECL analysis and calculation. Lesson number two will be geared towards real-life applications of CECL calculations and what we've seen over the past year with our clients. Lesson number three will dive into the evolving guidance from the standard-setting bodies and materiality discussions when calculating allowances. And finally, lesson number four will review some of the enhanced financial statement disclosures and what some of our clients' audit reports look like after the adoption of the standard. And we will try to save a bit of time at the end of our presentation for questions, so please feel free to ask a question in the chat box and we'll do our best to answer at the very end. All right, so let's start with an overview of the CECL standard. The Financial Accounting Standards Board, FASB, introduced this accounting standard update 2016-13, financial instruments/credit losses. And while the standard was released a few years ago, it became mandatory for fiscal years beginning after December 15, 2022, with an adoption date of January 1st, 2023, if you're a calendar year end. So if your fiscal year ends on December 31st, you were required to adopt this for fiscal year 2023. And the update primarily addresses losses related to financial instruments and loans, but it also applies to other financial assets, which is why we think it could impact all organizations. The standard replaces the incurred losses method, whereas organizations could record an allowance for doubtful accounts based on past experience that represents actual collections or lack thereof. So what does this mean? The organizations probably only recorded a loss when it was probable that a loss event had occurred, i.e. a borrower defaulting on a loan. You would only know that when the occurrence were to happen. So the CECL standard eliminates the probable threshold from the old incurred loss method and mandates that organizations estimate expected credit losses over the full life of a financial asset. So this requires consideration of current and future conditions rather than solely relying on those past events. So why did FASB introduce this standard? The standard really aims to provide a more accurate and timely reflection of credit risk, helping organizations better prepare for potential losses. And for today's webinar, our focus will be on the implications for the nonprofit sector. So I'd like to take a few minutes and review the financial assets within the scope of the CECL standard, and those as well as those with outside the scope on the next slide. So this review is crucial for analyzing an organization's CECL. And below, you'll see a list of financial assets within the CECL standard that we've most commonly encountered during the audits of nonprofit organizations over the past year. And as you can see below, all of the assets typically involve some form of credit exposure. The most common type we've encountered with our clients are receivables related to exchange transactions under ASC Accounting Standards Codification, ASC Topic 606. So these are going to be your reciprocal transactions where both parties receive a benefit from the exchange. So a fee for service, a membership due where a member is getting benefits in return. And then also notes or loans receivables with unrelated parties. And the key term here is unrelated, meaning not under common control. So the FASB has come out and said that loans from related parties may be more of a contribution rather than a genuine loan that is expected to be repaid. So FASB clearly distinguishes between related and unrelated party in this context. And other financial assets within the scope include off-balance sheet credit exposure, including financial guarantees, loan commitments, letters of credit. And another one listed here is lease receivables. So, for example, if your organization has a sublease, then there exists a risk that your subleasee may default on their payments. And finally, any other financial assets not scoped out where the organization has the right to receive cash. Okay, so let's go over some of the financial assets outside of the scope of CECL. Oops, sorry about that. Okay, so here's a list of the financial assets outside of the scope, and the first one being contributions receivable. So these are going to be your transactions covered by ASC Topic 958, your grants and contributions. Then we have listed investments measured at fair value. So these are excluded from CECL because they are already being reported at fair value, which inherently already reflects changes in market conditions and credit risk. Then we have loans extended to participants of a defined contribution employee benefit plan. So these are governed by relevant guidelines that reflect their particular risk and conditions. Then we have intercompany notes or loans receivables with related parties that we talked about above, and then receivables arising from operating leases held by the lessor. And finally, derivatives and hedging instruments. Again, these are governed by a different set of accounting guidelines that better address their unique nature and risks. So these are all outside of the scope of CECL. So let's go into lesson number one, which is back to the revenue recognition basics. So I'd like to share our experience as auditors over the past year and discuss how organizations have implemented the CECL standard and what we've seen. So what have we really observed? We've received numerous requests and questions from clients on accurately and how to calculate the allowance under the standard. And while we could provide guidance and assistance, we couldn't perform the calculations for our clients or make management decisions related to forecasting. So one of the items we most commonly notice is that clients often mixed their revenue and receivables subject to CECL with those not subject to CECL in their chart of accounts. So what does this mean? It means that when clients went to go initially begin their CECL analysis at the beginning of a fiscal year, they may have inadvertently included transactions outside of the scope of CECL or spent a considerable amount of time identifying the true nature of their receivables. Another common observation is the existence of revenue vehicles that incorporate both a contribution and an exchange element. So, for example, membership dues may include a portion that is a straightforward contribution to an organization, while another portion of that due provides a benefit to the member, such as discounts to a conference or access to re reading materials. So this created challenges when clients went to aggregate the transactions, as only that exchange component fell under the scope of CECL. So that piece needed to be pulled out, and that would be the only piece that you would incorporate into your CECL analysis. Additionally, we've observed that historical write-offs have not been distinguished by revenue stream. So when organizations went to review their write-offs over the past 3, 5, 10 years, whatever span they were trying to accomplish, they often encountered difficulties because the write-offs were not clearly linked to a specific revenue vehicle. So this lack of distinguishment meant it presented more challenges for clients to accurately unwind their write-offs over time and really see what transaction was written off and fell under the scope of the CECL standard. So in summary, we've noted that a lot of organizations required a refresher on ASC Topic 958, contributions, and ASC Topic 606, contract year, and occasionally needed to revisit or reassess their revenue recognition practices. So let's proceed by outlining the differences between a contribution and exchange transaction. And I know this kind of seems basic going back to a few years ago when Topic 606 first came out, but really this distinction has frequently posed challenges for our clients in preparing for their CECL analysis over the past year. So a contribution is a voluntary, non-reciprocal transfer of cash, assets, or promises to give to an entity. And revenue is recognized upon notification of an award and satisfaction of all conditions, if applicable. So this would include items such as an individual donation, grants from foundations, and even conditional awards from the U.S. government. And again, these would all be outside of the scope of CECL. So an exchange transaction, by definition, is a reciprocal transaction between two entities where each party receives equal value in return. Revenue is recognized when the performance obligation is fulfilled. And so examples here would include a fee for service, program income, events revenue, and these items, all of these items would be within inside the scope of CECL. So now let's review some of the things your organization can do to alleviate some of that burden of calculating the CECL year after year after year. So avoid mixing contributions and grants with exchange transactions in receivable accounts. So consider using separate accounts for different types of revenues. This approach really will ensure that when you go to analyze a specific account at a specific time period, the balance in that account will only include relevant transactions, eliminating the need to separate out of scope transactions under the CECL standard. Document CECL analysis exclusively for in-scope financial assets and receivables. This is going to ensure that you're not wasting time analyzing transactions that fall outside of the scope of the CECL standard. Again, I think this one is obvious and it might seem, simple that people wouldn't go and analyze transactions outside of the scope of CECL, but we did have a lot of clients over the past year where they weren't really sure what applied to them within the scope of CECL, so they really analyzed everything in their receivable accounts. So when we went to go perform the audit procedures, we had to tell them, hey, this is not within the scope of CECL. You need to back this out of your analysis. It could be bringing down your allowance. It could be raising your allowance. So really making sure that you know what is within the scope of the CECL standard. And if you're unsure about whether a transaction falls within the scope of the CECL standard, I'd recommend first reviewing those transactions that FASB describes as out of scope, as that may help. And the next one I have listed is have documented policies and procedures on each significant revenue stream, whether it's exchange or contribution based. This will ensure consistent application of the CECL methodology across all revenue streams and provide transparency in how organizations assess and manage credit risk. It seems obvious to have policies and procedures for all revenue streams, but a lot of our clients, you know, maybe their policies were outdated or they had not updated for new standards like this CECL one. So really making sure that clients are looking at their policies, updating them as needed, will really help with this. And finally, group financial assets into pools to estimate credit losses more accurately. FASB came out and said, instead of focusing on individual contracts or obligations, CECL considers credit losses as on a collective basis, using pools of financial assets with similar risk characteristics. So this approach is designed to provide a more comprehensive assessment of potential credit losses. So I'll hand it over to Jen now to discuss lesson number two, the real life applications of CECL calculation.
Thank you, Allison. Good morning, everyone. A pleasure to be on. So we're going to move into what we observed working with our clients during implementation year when it comes to the actual calculations. I want to remind everyone that there are still a number of different methodologies that can be applied, especially if you were to just Google CECL, it would list, you know, several methodologies. The standard really was aimed at the banking, the financial institutions for their loan portfolios. So a number of those methodologies, if you were to look it up online, really is focused for that industry. We're really just talking here today about the nonprofits, what is best for you all, and what we saw most commonly within that nonprofit base. So for the nonprofits, as Allison went through what is in scope for you all, it really is that 606, the exchange revenue. And those are your trade receivables. So any of those receivables relating to your exchange revenue transactions, your membership, your events, your registration fees, anything where people are paying for something and they're receiving a value in return. So what we're focusing really on today is those trade receivables for the nonprofits. That methodology is the loss rate aging method. So that is what we're going to walk through when we take a look at this historical loss, the current and the future. We are talking about what's referred to as the loss rate aging method. There are instances where we had a number of clients, just a few, certainly not the majority, that also were able to use what was the discounted cash flow method. And that's because those organizations were issuing long-term notes receivables or programmatic loans. So if you are a nonprofit that has loan portfolios within your programmatic activity, there would be an alternative method, not necessarily the loss rate aging method. You probably would look to that discounted cash flows method to apply. So we're not going to be talking about the discounted cash flows today, but we are going to focus on the loss rate method. So within that, you know, there's still with multiple of these methodologies, there's still the concept that you would need to do a three-part analysis calculation, starting with one, that historical loss piece, and then now introducing that current calculation and the future considerations. Really, we'll start with the historical loss, we'll work through the current and the future, what we saw. The historical loss piece was by far the easiest for clients to implement, easiest for everyone to understand. Especially as accountants, we like numbers. This was very data-driven calculation. We could easily take data and come to a conclusion. And it very much aligns with that old methodology on your bad debt, you know, saying that over the past however many years, we had our collectibility or our loss rate was 2%, and that's our allowance policy. So what we observed in the first piece of that calculation on the historical losses, one, everyone liked it. Two, that the most common time period that organizations were taking a look at was a five-year look back. So there was certainly no guidance on how many years an organization had to go back and look. Five seemed to be the magic number. There were certainly some that started with three, expanded, some that went as far as 10, a few in that seven. But five seemed to be the magic number to take a look at those prior year write-offs and collectability. So what organizations soon found out is that in looking at that five-year time frame, there were several who had COVID implications within that time frame. So many realizing that this once-in-a-lifetime event was skewing really their historical loss calculation. And they had to make decisions on whether that's truly a reflection of what the organization's normal operations was. If it's not, it, in some instances, it was backed out. It was pulled out to say, you know, this wasn't a representation of our normal operations. And so we did have a couple of clients that ended up pulling out certain scenarios, pulling out certain percentages, or applying a different methodology, meaning that any COVID refunds or write-offs were really just segregated and analyzed separately. So that was one thing that was very interesting that came up quite a bit. In that, a couple of those organizations that realized they had a big impact, COVID impact within that five-year data set, then expanded the time frame, right? Because the more data, the longer the time, the more normalized the percentage you would have. So we did have a couple that went that route as well. You know, Allison already mentioned the third bullet point here, what we saw a lot of as they were going through that five-year look back and trying to flag the write-offs in the varying aging buckets. You know, the bad debt wasn't classified by whether it was exchange write-off or maybe you had contributions, pledges. It was all just booked to bad debt, right? So there were a lot of organizations that had to go through and unwind the bad debt expense accounts over the past 5 years to say, okay, this write-off wasn't related to the exchange piece. This was contribution. And that also needs to be taken out of the percentages that you are applying to those aging buckets. Obviously, that loss rate aging method is what organizations applied by calculating the receivables in those aging buckets. That is the methodology. So obviously we saw a lot of organizations with that 90-day and over category being the highest percentage of that historic loss. That's exactly what we would expect. But really the calculation, making sure that those write-offs too were flagged to the different aging buckets, right? So not only to the types of revenue, but a write-off, knowing whether that customer at that point in time was a current write-off, you know, sitting in the current bucket or in over 1 year, whatever it was, that came into play as well in the calculation. Because obviously, if you have a receivable balance at year end, the largest you would hope is in the current portion. So you don't want to take a flat rate of a five-year write-off and apply it to your current. You would want to apply it to the smaller 90-day note. So we did have a number of organizations have to do some research and digging in further on those write-offs and which aging buckets they really fell into to come up with an accurate calculation. And we saw a lot of organizations establishing an allowance for the very first time. I don't think this is specific to the historical loss, but I think it ties in because even under the historical loss methodology, if you had low write-offs in the past, you probably were able to justify the fact that, we really don't need to establish a provision. Whereas, that's a different sentiment when it comes to CECL, and we'll talk a little bit more about that over the next couple slides and the current guidance. It was much harder under this analysis to justify a zero loss just based on the historical, because there's still two more factors to consider. The current conditions. So, like I mentioned, historical, I think, was probably the easiest for our clients to digest. The current and the future conditions were new to everyone. So I think the first thing that we saw here was it took a lot of retraining and the on your thought process on why you would need to evaluate for current conditions, what that means when it comes to how it correlates with your historical loss. For this piece, we saw a lot for current and future. We saw a lot of finance personnel work outside of their department, right? So, a lot of the CFOs, finance look to other people within their firm, maybe like programmatic people, more strategic development people, to get a sense of the industry, what they're thinking about, what's happening in the market for their client base in over the next couple of years. So we saw a lot of involvement from non-finance personnel in the current and future conditions piece of these calculations. One client very heavy on publishing books or publishing revenues. They went to their publishing department, right? They had the CFO wasn't really didn't have their hand or on the pulse of what's going on in the publishing industry, but they have a department of 20 people in publishing. Well, the publishing department was very involved in the current and future positions, justifying what they think and why they think the X, Y, and Z of their specific calculations. So, we did see that come up quite a bit. Another thing just on that thought process, which Allison will go over in a little bit. We often have the, well, it's all been subsequently collected. And so, why do I need a current or a future or even a historical if everything is subsequently collected? So, we had to go back to the guidance and just retrain how we're thinking about this because that used to be an okay justification under the old methodology. But CECL really requires organizations to establish the allowance, if we're being very technical, at the time the revenue is recorded, right? So you're not doing the analysis months later during audit time, which is subsequent to year end, and you already know that the revenues are collected. It's in the instance that you're recording the receivable. Technically, that's when the allowance should be established. Obviously, in practice, that's not really the case, especially when it comes to nonprofits. So it was very hard to bridge the technical guidance with the fact that we all knew everything was subsequently collected, which really wasn't the intent of the standard. And so we'll give some more guidance there. But that was by far one of the biggest challenges that we also saw when we're talking about these current and future predictions with our organizations. Current conditions. So, if you're an organization that really had no changes in operations, you have the same exact revenue types, very consistent 1 year to the next, same number of members, no significant changes in your base or the types of offerings, there were no adjustments for those current or future, or in this case, just the current conditions. So remember that the current and the future is just an adjustment to your historical. So if you had 5% write-off, the current would have been zero in this case because everything is so consistent. It was the next kind of level where we saw there was significant turnover, or policy changes that did impact those current conditions. So it was much more likely to see our clients had made an adjustment to their historical loss, either upwards or downwards, because they either internally had some level of turnover, let's say on the development side where people were really focusing on collections and that wasn't the case during this current year, or the policy in which, let's say they used to only bill in advance and now they're billing after the fact. Well, that's certainly going to adjust how successful you are in collecting your receivables. So when there was some sort of turnover or policy change, or even new revenue stream or new offerings, that is when we saw most adjustments in that current conditions. We also saw some organizations take into consideration the current conditions based on the fact that it was an election year. If your activities are politically driven, this definitely had an impact on some that were either increasing or decreasing their provision based on the fact that this current year is an election year. And you might see that on the next slide, they bring it down in the future because the next couple of years are not. And so that's kind of the thought process that some of those clients had when they walked through, when they were justifying the percentages that they were applying to the current AR. And then a lot looked outside of their organization on industry trends, pulling from, you know, there's a lot of data out there publicly on industries. The Bureau of Labor Statistics gives some good overall summaries and a variety of industries on what they think the current conditions are, and this even extends to the future conditions. So a number did look outside at just the overall general economic outlook within their industry and how that would play into their current factor as well as the future factor. So for those future conditions, so one of the things that we saw most within the future, just the first part of this is the technical language where you're required to address and come up with that reasonable and supportable forecast about future conditions. Well, we mostly saw that future for most organizations didn't span beyond a year or two in most cases. I think if we could all tell the future beyond that, maybe we wouldn't be accountants, but nonetheless, you know, if I had a crystal ball, most organizations were aligning the future with the length of those revenue terms, right? So if your membership term was for a year, 2 years, if you had a contract maybe that spans 5 years, okay, you might want to kind of predict a little bit farther out. But in most cases, we were looking ahead to the next year or two. Very similar to the current condition situation, future often, if there was turnover now that I had to consider, they predicted stabilization in the future, right? Whether that's stabilization internally, and stabilization in the future condition would have a negative adjustment, right? Meaning that if I'm predicting a higher write-off, upward percentage, then stabilization would then bring it back down. So, and oftentimes the future was a reduction of the current and the historical losses, which meaning it's reducing the overall allowance that you have. Relationship changes played a lot into those future conditions. So for example, you know, your relationship with the people that are paying. So again, and this played into a couple of different things, election year, turnover in administration, if your contracts are with government agencies, you know, we saw there be a higher percentage of knowing that if there's high turnover in those agencies, collectability might not be as good as it was in prior years. And I use the government agencies not because of the government grants, but more of the fee for service that we're talking about there. So we did have a number of clients have to look to whether they had stable relationships with their customer base, and those that weren't, or those that had turnover or external, definitely had to pull that in as well. And then a number of organizations had to consider future change in offerings. So for example, membership types, you know, if you would offer, let's say, a lifetime membership, or we had organizations offering lifetime memberships where they could collect over a number of months in advance, they changed that offering to say they were no longer, you know, allow for payment plans on a certain type of revenue stream. And so that change in the methodology or the change in the offering of services played a huge impact into their future considerations, because if they were now billing up front and collecting up front in advance, it was very different than having receivable on the books for, let's say, a year or two in which someone could pay. So that methodology then was built into their future forecasts as an upward or a downward adjustment. So those are by far the biggest components that we saw a lot of organizations consider. You know, one of the things that Allison briefly mentioned is that the types of activities needed to be grouped together. So a lot of organizations were doing calculations for a number of revenue streams, right? So let's say you had advertising, you have membership, you have events and conferences, you have educational programming. That's four different calculations, because all of those are very different components, very different deliverables, very different factors to consider. So I think that was also something that was pretty surprising to a lot of organizations when they started going down this process of, you know, I'm not just doing this one time, I might be doing this four times for my four big revenue streams. So surprise. So here's just a nice summary example of what we walked through, starting with that historical loss. First, you see that 80% applying mostly to that 91 and over. And as you get more into the current bucket, you see it's a much less percentage. And that is that loss aging methodology, right? That you want to apply those calculations to the various buckets. And then here, just being a current condition, was adjusted upward based on their analysis. They know there's turmoil in the industry, it's experiencing challenges, but in future, they expect those will rebound for whatever reason. This is just a nice summary of that methodology and really what most clients used as the example framework for when they were applying their specific calculation.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. This brings us to polling question number two. Did your organization's CECL analysis indicate a material credit loss allowance for fiscal year 2023? Yes, no, or unsure? As a reminder, if you'd like CPE credit, please record a response to this question. And then in the survey that pops up following the webinar, please indicate that you indeed would like CPE credit. Looks like we're 100% answered here, and the majority is saying that no, it did not result in a material allowance.
Lucky, lucky. I'm going to quickly just go through what we saw the disclosures look like for CECL. Couple of items that after you went through all the calculation, you know, we'll talk a little bit about materiality. Impact of adoption could be considered immaterial and result in disclosures only. Either way, whether it was material or not, there were changes in your financial statements. Again, either whether it was re-looking at how AR is classified between exchange and contribution, that might have resulted in reclassifications. there were enhanced disclosures on here about those contract assets and liabilities and how those link to the revenue streams. Again, just stressing the importance of the separation within the GL and clearly understanding whether it's a contribution or an exchange. So a lot of you might have seen those enhanced disclosures this year. Oftentimes the term for allowance for doubtful accounts for those exchange transactions or the bad debt was replaced with the allowance for credit losses or credit loss expense. You know, those are just fundamentally terminology changes, not much more besides that. But I think the biggest thing was the roll forward of the credit loss. So when you did have a provision in there, there was a new requirement to ensure that you disclose the period over period changes in your estimation. And the easiest way to do that is to do it. But we most often saw that organizations did just go through that roll forward of the beginning, any additions, any write-offs to get to the end of that that balance. So here's a very basic example, allowance for credit losses at the beginning of the year. And remember, the standard was also another thing we observed was the fact that this wasn't adopted as of the end of your year. It was adopted as of the very first day of your fiscal year. So you were doing a calculation as of the beginning of the year and then again at the end of the year. So for this, you know, technically is the correct presentation on the very first day of your year end, what that loss was. That's what you were recording in the financials initially, making your adjustments to get to the ending balance. So this was a very common presentation that we saw, and this is really where we saw that enhanced disclosure on the linkage between the assets that it's being evaluated. In this case, you know, this client, their contract services was the most material revenue stream. They did have some dues and lease income in there. And so this is on the asset side, less that allowance that we saw. And there are instances where you have those contracts on the liability side. So meaning you have deferred revenue, those funds that you've received in advance for contract services and dues to get to the total liability. Oh, another polling question. That was one.
All right, polling question number three. How frequently will your organization review its CECL analysis? A, monthly, B, quarterly, C, yearly, or D, unsure? I think this is a great question. Looks like we have pretty good spread of responses here. The majority is leaning towards a yearly review of the analysis. Thank you, everybody, for your participation in that polling question.
All right, so I'm going to take it over from here. Let's review some of the evolving guidance and the lessons learned, as well as let's address some frequently asked questions from the Center for Plain English Accounting. So the Center for Plain English Accounting says justifying a zero provision for CECL can be challenging, even if historical data shows no credit losses. So even if past losses were zero, future economic conditions or changes in borrowing behavior or customer behavior could impact expected losses. So these conditions can fluctuate daily, right? No one knows what's going to happen tomorrow, a week from today, or even a year from today. So this is why, you know, relying solely on prior data is not always going to justify that zero provision for future periods. Now, on the flip side, they've also stated that it is theoretically possible, based on the plain language of FASB ASC 326, which is the CECL, to support a zero expected credit loss assertion for the trade accounts receivables. So this holds true in cases where historical experience shows zero credit losses, no write-offs, and then current conditions and reasonable supportable forecasts continue to indicate zero credit losses. This type of analysis, it's going to require strong, consistent evidence and thorough documentation. So, you know, as auditors come in and see this CECL analysis and you're saying that there's no losses expected in the future, we're going to need to see some documentary evidence that really supports your allowance analysis and really determining that zero is correct at that point in time. So yes, let's review some of the frequently asked questions that were submitted to the Center for Plain English Accounting over the past year in dealing with the CECL adoption. So the first one, can subsequent events such as collection of trade receivables after the balance sheet date be considered in developing a measure of credit losses under CECL? So this Center for Plain English Accounting, of course, they come back and say that it depends. So essentially they stated that when determining a credit loss, an entity should not recognize the effects of any events occurring after the balance sheet date, but before the financials are issued. However, subsequent events should be reflected in the estimate of credit losses if an entity determines that an error correction is necessary. So as Jen mentioned earlier, relying solely on subsequent receipts is not an accurate method for credit losses. FASB does not want this to play into someone's analysis. So again, typically when you're recording your financial transactions and receivables, you would be recording an allowance at that time. You wouldn't have the knowledge of subsequent collections, that information available to make a reasonable and supported forecast of a credit loss at that point in time. And many of our clients, like Jen mentioned earlier, again, they tended to incorporate that subsequent collections into their CECL analysis when we began the audit field work. Again, it seems logical that future collections would prevent a loss. Obviously, you've collected the cash. So, but FASB does dictate that the analysis must be based on the criteria we've discussed above in this webinar, rather than on subsequent receipts. All right, so let's do another question that has been asked of them. Since FASB ASC 606 requires collection of the consideration expected to be probable in order to recognize revenue in step one, if you're doing that five-step method, why is any credit loss necessary under CECL and FASB ASC 326 for trade receivables already subject to ASC 606? And this is a common question I've gotten asked from my clients over the past year. Why would an organization need to determine a credit loss on a revenue stream where they've already fulfilled the performance obligation and they're entitled to the revenue, right? They've satisfied the performance obligation and they're going to get that revenue. So why do they need to, you know, perform an analysis or an expected credit loss? Well, the Center for Plain English Accounting breaks it down into two components. First, CECL does not include a recognition threshold and requires the measurement of remote risk of credit losses as opposed to that probable collection under ASC Topic 606. So in this context, we're really distinguishing between the terms remote and probable. And second, under CECL, the unit of account is generally broader than under ASC 606. So while the unit of account under 606 is either that contract or that individual performance obligation, CECL requires a broader unit of account based on the pooling notion in ASC 326. So to break this down a little bit further, ASC 606 aims to ensure revenue is recognized when it is earned and realizable. CECL focuses on providing a more accurate representation of credit loss and expected losses on the receivables. And additionally, revenue recognition under Topic 606 occurs when the performance obligation is satisfied. But CECL is going to require organizations to estimate expected losses at each reporting date, considering current conditions and reasonable forecasts. So let's take another look at another question posed to them. In developing a measure of credit losses under CECL, ASC 326, can we solely use historical experience and not consider current conditions and reasonable and supportable forecasts? I hope everyone on this webinar is saying the same thing right now. Absolutely not. FASB 326 indicates that an entity shall not solely rely on past events to estimate credit losses. So, when an entity uses historical loss information, it shall consider the need to adjust historical information to reflect the extent to which management expects current conditions and reasonable and supportable forecasts to differ from the current conditions that existed for the period over which historical information was evaluated. So, what does that mean in simpler terms? Management needs to modify the historical data to reflect current economic conditions and circumstances, which may be different from the past. Generally, it will be different from the past. So, management also needs to incorporate future expectations based on reasonable and supportable forecasts. These forecasts could include factors like economic trends, changes in market conditions, any relevant information that could affect credit losses. Jen mentioned earlier the change in administration. So, things that you're looking outside your particular organization and considering in your analysis. All right, so let's review some takeaways and final thoughts. So, even if your organization has never recorded an allowance for doubtful accounts before, never booked a loss in the accounting system, your auditors are going to expect to see an allowance for credit losses recorded on January 1st, 2023, and December 31st, 2023, assuming you're a calendar year end, and then subsequently thereafter. Now, Jen mentioned this earlier, materiality does influence decisions to record an allowance on your books. If the allowance is clearly immaterial to your financial statements, you have the right to make that decision to not record that adjustment on your books. However, it is crucial that you include all that relevant information to your auditors so that they can see that you've correctly applied the CECL standard and that we have, agreed with your initial thoughts that the allowance would be immaterial to recording in your financial statements. And to reiterate, nonprofits can no longer use the direct write-off method. CECL has replaced this entirely. Additionally, nonprofits will not be able to assert that all receivables are 100% collectible without substantial documentation using the CECL framework to support that assertion. So, even if the risk of loss is considered highly remote, nonprofits are still required to estimate the lifetime credit losses within the scope of the new standard. And unlike the previous incurred loss method, the new expected credit loss does not specify a threshold for recognizing an allowance for credit losses. And lastly, I would recommend that you share your CECL documentation with your auditors before your audit fieldwork begins to avoid any surprises, any audit adjustments, things like that. And again, while auditors cannot make assumptions or estimate your credit losses for you, they can review your analysis and provide feedback as necessary. Read through everything and make sure that you're applying all the relevant information that the CECL and the FASB has come out with over the past year. So this concludes our discussion on the CECL lessons learned. Now I'm going to open it up and see if we've received any questions in the chat.
Yeah, thank you very much, Allison and Jennifer. We do have a couple questions that came in here a few minutes ago. So the first one is really related to, I know we touched on it briefly, but if you at the time of the audit you see that you have 100% subsequent collections, then does it really make sense that you had recorded, an expected credit loss? I was wondering if you could add a little commentary surrounding that.
Yes, we hear that a lot. Yes, so remember, just technically, it's not an analysis you should be doing at the time of the audit, right? It's analysis that should be done when you record the revenue. Of course, if you've subsequently received it, that has to come in play, right? You can't look the other way and just say, you're going to book something when you know it's 100% collectible. So for me, what I look is not necessarily the explanation or the documentation of, well, we've received 100% subsequently collections, but more of the thought process in the three buckets, right? My historical losses, if there is a percentage, you know, I would say it's hard to justify having no allowance when you historically have had uncollectible items. But if it's low, maybe we can consider it immaterial and we don't need to record it. So, you know, you can work with your auditors to talk through those things. But I want to look at your documentation on the historical piece, the current and the future. And just remember, it's an estimate. You know, you're giving us your best position, your best explanation, and we're there to evaluate whether we think it's reasonable based on the information we're receiving. So, and oftentimes it is a collaborative process, and it goes back more to documentation and how it's presented to your audit team than anything else.
Thanks, Jennifer. We also received one comment here, a question related to just the CECL implementation, and it kind of going the other way than you would normally expect. In this example, the allowance prior to CECL was actually higher just due to the volume and size of the AR. And after going through the CECL steps, it resulted in an allowance much lower than they previously had. So what would you recommend if management deems that the CECL allowance is actually unreasonably low?
Well, why is it unreasonable? You know, because like obviously you're calculating it based on something, right? Like, so if you're starting with your historical losses and you're getting a percentage, if you're adjusting that downward based on your expected current and future conditions, and that's why it's lower, like you had to think that you truly are going to collect more in current and future. That's what you're saying. So I would go back and see why you're saying it doesn't feel right. What is that? Is that in the fact that maybe it's been unreasonably high in the past, that your historical is lower than what you have on your books? Or is it that the current and future, what you're saying probably isn't going to occur and it needs to be adjusted there? So I would, I would go back and say, why does that feel low for you all? It should feel exactly where you think it's going to go, because that's what you're documenting as your current and future.
Thanks for that answer, Jennifer. Appreciate that. This last question is actually one of my questions. I know our last polling question said, how frequently, you know, do people expect to go back and revisit their CECL analysis? Just a question for you guys. What would you recommend the frequency be to revisit that analysis?
Allison, do you want to
Yeah, I can take this one. So I would recommend at least annually, you're going to need to review that CECL analysis to align with your financial statement preparation and audit, right? But if there's, you know, changes in certain conditions, changes in your forecast for future conditions, then you could definitely adjust it quarterly. We've had some clients ask about that. And so that's not a problem either. But I think the median, I would say right now, is leaning towards yearly, but definitely revisiting it if anything were to significantly change with your assumptions that you've already included in your analysis.
I agree. And some organizations that it has a material impact, they want it for budgeting purposes, right? Like they want to have a sense of, okay, we have a budget. And if it's going to change by $200,000, that might be a lot for a small nonprofit. So I know those have really tried to do it quarterly so that there are no surprises come like year-end adjustment time for purposes of presenting like a budget to your internal board.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jennifer and Allison. Really appreciate it. And thank you everybody for attending. Please do not forget to complete the survey that will pop up automatically at the end of the webinar. Thanks again and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the GRF On The Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.